From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. David Kessler is one of the world's best-known experts on grief and loss. In 2004, he and Elizabeth Kubler-Ross co-wrote On Grief and Grieving, Finding the Meaning of Grief Through the Five Stages of Loss. They completed that book shortly before Kubler-Ross died. And the book has since become a foundational text that has helped define our understanding of how humans experience and process loss. And David Kessler joins us from Los Angeles today. David, thank you so much for being with us. I just want to start by asking, did you ever think that you would witness a time where so many people, I mean, even billions of people, are collectively experiencing so many different types of grief at the same time?
Not in this lifetime. Absolutely not. It is truly astounding and devastating and strange to see this happening in the world.
And so as you try to think your way through this, where do you start? Where do you begin?
Well, there's two things that are going on in my world. There's certainly this new collective grief that people are just figuring out how to name, that they're waking up going, I'm crying, I don't know why, or there's this heaviness. So there is the collective grief in the air of a world we have all lost that was here a month ago. In the strangest way, we are experiencing the sudden death of a world we knew.
Ah.
At the same time, the other end is there are people who have had loved ones die in the past month, in the past week, in the past day, who for the first time in our history, no matter whether you look back at war or 9/11 or the AIDS crisis, AIDS epidemic, we've never not been able to bury our dead or have a funeral or go to a grief group. So there is this collective grief of a world that's gone that's now lost. And there's the grief of a loved one who's died that you can't mourn them with others.
Mm-hmm. It is okay to call what people are feeling grief. That is what it is.
Grief is a change, usually one we didn't want. So grief is a change that happens. And, you know, I look at everything as a grief. Obviously, the one we know the most and that is clearly the most painful is a true physical death of a loved one. But, you know, the reality is I think of divorce as the death of a marriage and, you know, a job loss as the death of that work relationship. And this is the death of our normal life that we had and our world that we were in. So it is the death of something. I always say, you know, grief is a non-judgmental, no comparison zone. So I don't want us to, you know, people want to decide which is the worst grief. And I always go, the worst grief is yours.
Mm. Well, thank you so much for saying that, David, because even just this morning in our editorial meeting, as we were talking, we were sort of catching ourselves saying, well, the grief that that I might be feeling today because my regular routine is gone, I can't really compare that. And I shouldn't compare that to the grief of someone who's experiencing the death of a loved one right now. And I think, so there's a profound tendency to sort of, I don't know if it's minimize or apologize for or try to keep one's own grief in check in situations like this.
Right. And, you know, we have to realize, listen, you know, my background, people know that, you know, I started this world with a mother dying when I was young and being in a shooting. So I had my share of grief mm-hmm. as a young child. And then this new work that I've come out with is came about because of the sudden death of my younger son a few years ago. Mm-hmm. So I have had my share of physical death. And with that said, I also recognize that if someone in this pandemic had to cancel her wedding that she's been planning since 5 years old, that might be the worst loss she had. And her loss doesn't invalidate mine, and mine doesn't invalidate hers. We both can have our own losses, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, You mentioned your son who passed
yes.
away.
David, yes.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about that for a second? Because and how the less, I mean, you have been doing this work for so long, and yet again, you were hit with this indescribable wrenching loss. I mean, how you want to reflect on that a little bit, given the world that we're all trying to figure out right now?
Well, I certainly had thought, you know, my losses were behind me in my childhood. I didn't expect such a devastating loss. Not that anyone ever, even being a grief specialist, it was just brutal. And, you know, people would say, what's it like for the grief expert to, you know, have to lose his son? And I said, you know, it wasn't about the grief expert. It was about the father who had to bury a child. And as I was going through that deep pain and still continue to go through it, I was so aware of, oh, here I am angry. Here's that stage. Here's the, I can't believe this is happening. There's that stage. And I would just sort of also see myself going through grief experiences. And as you mentioned, Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and I adapted her original stages from Dying to Grief. And I always remind people on page one of that first book we did on grief and grieving, we say they're not linear. They're not a map for grief. Your grief is as unique as your fingerprint. I think it's been challenging that they've become five easy steps for grief. And, you know, and grief is a very organic, messy lifetime experience we go through. But I found as I was beginning to sort of deal with the idea of accepting my loss, that acceptance just wasn't enough for me.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt there needed to be more. And that more for me, I had studied Viktor Frankl's work, and that more for me was meaning. And so, you know, I began finding my part of my own healing by talking with people who had lost a spouse after 30 years, or a sibling, or a parent, or a child, or a pet, who had found meaning. And so I became sort of engulfed in this meaning in a search for my own healing. And that became the book, Finding Meaning, The Sixth Stage of Grief. And I'm so honored that the Kubler-Ross family and foundation gave me permission to add a sixth stage to her iconic stages.
Yeah. And David, we're going to want to explore profoundly with you how we can all collectively find meaning
right.
In this moment now. But I also just want to let people know that we have an excerpt of David Kessler's new book, Finding Meaning. That excerpt is at onpointradio.org. David, one more thing. And I just actually want to start by to preface this with a thank you, because in your conversation with our producer as we were getting ready for today's program, you reminded her that, like you had said in a previous interview, that you as a bereaved parent yourself are giving everybody permission to just honor and experience it, whatever grief they're feeling right now. And I just wanted to say thank you for that. Because that's an incredibly generous thing.
Well, it does. You know, listen, I could not say to my older son right now, who's lost his job because of this, I couldn't turn to him and go, oh, your grief doesn't count because remember, you know, my son, your brother died. That's the only one. I mean, grief is not exclusive. You know, the reality is there's so many different types of losses, and I don't want anyone to minimize what they're going through, because, you know, everyone's struggling with things we know nothing about. And if this is their worst struggle, I want them to honor that. And I, as a bereaved parent, can validate that for them.
Mm. Well, this has really touched a lot of people, this notion of giving what we're collectively experiencing a name. And Emma Safi Wilson, for example, she sent us this comment. She says, for me, the grief is stemming from the lack of choice and freedom to continue working, just being the way we were. People appear to be adapting to this radical change, perhaps better than I, the swift leap to carry on as normal, albeit via a screen, though, is not soothing the wound. So I think Emma's getting to something very fundamental there, that even if this is temporary, it's a fundamental change in a way of being. And that's quite a profound loss, is it not?
Absolutely. And the other thing that we're all feeling, and we know somewhere deep inside, and I'm, you know, trying to name it for people, is that the world we knew a month ago is actually gone forever. Correct. It doesn't mean our life is over. It doesn't mean a lot of this isn't temporary. But it does mean the same way we used to say, do you remember before 9/11 what airports were like, that you could walk in, meet someone at the gate? In the future, we're going to say to each other, do you remember the world before the pandemic? And I don't know what that's going to look like. Maybe we're going to say, do you remember how we used to shake hands? Or maybe it'll be like, do you know there wasn't sanitizers on every corner? I mean, I don't know what that new world will look like, but I know the world so sadly that we had a month ago is gone. And we do have to name it and grieve it, because that's where we find our power to create our new lives moving forward.
I don't deny the truth of what you're saying, David, but I will be perfectly honest. I struggle with it. Because part of my
that's grief. You're supposed to struggle with grief. Grief is not easy.
I mean, part of my bulwark in sort of having a steady hand at the tiller in this moment is thinking, well, we will return to some kind of normalcy that's
absolutely
familiar.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But it will be different. Well, we absolutely. I mean, look, I have no doubt we're going to hug again. We're going to get together, but things will be different.
Well, we're going to talk about how we sort of approach that difference together when we come back from a quick break. David Kessler joins us this hour. We are talking about that thing that you're feeling. May not leave you so very comfortable right now. Maybe you just know what it is. We're calling it grief today, and how we process that and what we do about it. So we'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about grief and grieving in the midst of a global pandemic, or because of this global pandemic that we're all trying to live through. I'm joined today by David Kessler. He is founder of grief.com, and he's author of many best-selling books on grief, including On Grief and Grieving, that he co-authored with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. His latest book is Finding Meaning, The Sixth Stage of Grief, and we have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. And, you know, yesterday we asked, and over the weekend, we asked On Point listeners to share with us how they're feeling at this moment. So let's hear what some of our listeners had to say. Gabriella, she called us from Princeton, New Jersey. Her father passed away about 20 years ago when she was 28 years old. And she said right now, she's reminded of that grief again.
In an instant, our lives had changed so fundamentally in so many ways. I have a roof over my head and food to eat, but I'm being by myself at home. I'm being alone and feeling that my days have all of a sudden just have no purpose. It makes me question, how will I be able to pull through the next weeks and months, not just financially, but emotionally. I guess the big part of it is how everything seems so uncertain. I struggle with depression, and now more than ever, I feel so isolated. Yes, I can still talk with my family and friends over the phone, but there are just so much that I don't know. There's so many unknowns. I feel I have a big loss of control over my life.
That's Gabriella from Princeton, New Jersey. David Kessler, you know, when she really just tugged at my heart when Gabriella said that she feels like she's lost her sense of purpose. I think a lot of people are struggling with that right now. How do you cope with that?
Well, I think a number of things. We're realizing that our friendships, our connections, our work, so many things are our identity that are challenged right now. And the other thing that she mentioned that's very true in grief is new losses trigger old losses. Mm-hmm. And, you know, many people are having so much old grief bubble up. And there's another side to this. Not only are there people like her that are having old grief bubble up, but what I've gotten thousands of letters from people, emails from people like her who were dealing with loss 30 years ago, 5 years ago, a year ago, and even can't go to their physical grief group that they would normally go to for support. I actually answered a call the other day of a woman whose husband died 2 weeks ago. And she is alone in her apartment after 40 years with her husband. And she says she's just sitting there. She was going to go to her grief group that got canceled. So all of this just broke my heart to hear this. And one of the things that I started is an online daily check-in Facebook group for anyone who's struggling with grief after the death of a loved one, because I just couldn't stand to think of everyone so isolated at home without others to share with. And it's shocking to me. In our first day of starting that group, we had 1,000 people in it.
Wow.
So people are struggling out there. And that information's at grief.com about how to find that group on Facebook.
Well, David, hang on here for just a minute, because this is the perfect segue for me to bring in another voice into this conversation. So Sonia Lott joins us from Philadelphia. She's with us via Skype. She's a psychologist specializing in anticipatory, acute, and complicated grief counseling. And she's founder and CEO of Continuing Education in Multicultural Psychology. Sonia Lott, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. I'm grateful to be here with you.
I'm grateful to have you. First of all, how are you doing right now in this moment?
I am doing really, really well, and I'm grateful that that's the truth in this moment.
Good. Well, I'm trying to remember to check in with all our guests as they give us the generosity of their time and thought on the show. And I'll ask David, I'll check in with you about that in just a second, too. I haven't forgotten. But Sonia, talk to me for a moment about, you know, how David was reflecting on Gabriella, our listener who called in, and then also sharing the fact that there are griefs that people were already living with and trying to work through when this current moment hit.
Mm-hmm.
Where do they begin to try to work through it all?
Well, the first piece of it, the first task, is acceptance right where we are. We have to, on some level, surrender to what our reality is. We never sign up for loss, ever, ever, ever. But once loss happens, in order to find meaning in the loss, who am I? How do I go forward? You know, how do I deal with the not knowing? How do I find a sense of purpose? All of those things, we first have to surrender to what is. And right now, we are in a really scary place, particularly because it's a collective conglomerate of losses on so many levels. Some of us already have lost loved ones, but as David mentioned, we're losing so many things. And Gabriella talked about this too, the loss of the sense of purpose, the loss of the illusion, is what I always say, of having control over our lives, the loss of social connection. And we tend to lean on each other, hug more, be together when we experience loss or when we're fearful. And because of the virus, we're not able to do that right now. Hmm. So the first step is acknowledging we are in this really scary, unknown place. And so that's the first thing, then we can begin to, and that's a process over time, but then we can begin to look at moment by moment. Anytime we go too far out in the future, we're going to feel anxious because we can never know what the future holds. That's especially true right now. So we need to try to stay as close to the moment as possible. Today, I have adequate supplies. Today, I haven't lost a loved one. Today, I'm feeling fine. You know, that type of thing, as close to the now as we can be.
May I ask you, Sonia, so I completely hear what you're saying, sort of focusing on what's working, what are sources of comfort and joy now in the present, because the future, you can imagine yourself into all different kinds of darker futures. But is there a tension here that none of us, you know, collectively as a society have ever had to contend with? And what I'm getting at is sometimes I find myself, for example, actually trying to think myself out of the present because the present isn't so great, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the present is this terrible moment where we're concerned about a pandemic, where the sheer act of our daily lives is completely changed. As David called it before, we are all experiencing change we didn't want. It can be. I find it sometimes to be a little unpleasant to really focus on what's happening in the here and now. And I think to myself, well, in the future, when we get to the other side of whatever this curve is, things will be more familiar. I want to try to do that, but I'm hearing you say maybe. Is that not a good way to try and cope?
Well, actually, there's a dual process theory of grief that suggests that it's really important for us to oscillate or vacillate between loss orientation and restoration orientation, that we need to spend not necessarily equal amount of times, but give attention to both being present to the loss and all of the emotions, and including fear, sadness, anger, whatever it might be, that comes up around that. That's part of the reality. Here, this is what's happening in the world. This is how I'm responding to it, and being able to be present to that while at the same time holding as much gratitude and joy as you can. And so both can exist. You can vacillate between the two, or you can hold them simultaneously. So you're not denying either that they're joy, joyful moments or things we can be grateful for, but we can be profoundly sad because we may not have a job anymore, or we really miss the people that we usually, you know, are connected with. We may even be missing the people at work we don't even like, but we have, you know, they're our second family. We have a relationship with them. So it's not to dwell only on the really bad things, because this is a really bad time. It's a uniquely stressful, scary, real time. But we can also begin to look into what the future will bring, because we have to, A, make meaning of what's happening right now, collectively and individually, and then to try to find purpose, as Gabriella talked about, that she's struggling with right now, for moving forward. How are we going to, in hopefully magnificent ways, create a new normal, a new way of being that is different, but equally or even better than the life we've lived to date, both individually and globally.
Right. Well, Sonia and David, let me just say to both of you that I don't necessarily want to be the interlocutor between the two of you. I'm more than happy to step back, honestly, and listen to the two of you talk to each other and be our guides in terms of how to get through this historic experience for humanity here. So David and Sonia, feel free to talk to each other.
You know, one thing I would say that goes along with what Sonia just shared, just how it's working in my own life right now. Obviously, people are calling, we're all calling each other, canceling events, canceling a million plans we had. Mm-hmm. I noticed for me, when I got a call saying something was canceled, done, that's it. It affected me differently than someone who called and said, we're canceling this, but let's look at September. Let's look at December. Mm-hmm. Because just like Sonia said, it seemed to help me to have the disappointment of the cancellation at the same time realize, oh, and there is a future. This can still happen, but in a September, in a December, in next year, so that we're reminded of the grief we have to go through in what we've lost now, and to realize there will be something after this for us to invest in.
That's right. Yeah. I think that's really true. I think another thing is that we, one of the things that's happening is that we're learning just how much we can use technology to stay connected. You know, events that are being canceled, there are also events that are being converted to online gatherings. And granted, it's not the same as being present with someone and being able to hug and, you know, all of those beautiful things, but things can still happen. We can still be together in the ways that we have available online. You know, if it's a conference, if it's a family meeting, if it's a happy hour or having dinner with the family via, you know, everybody online. So yeah, it's learning creative new ways to stay connected.
Yeah. Well, can I just play a little bit more from what our listeners have sent us? Because the diversity of experience out there is truly remarkable. And I'm so glad that people are willing to share their thoughts with us. So here is what John, a recently retired prison chaplain, told us. He's in Marshall, Missouri.
I just wanted to say, in my work in the prison, I was so often with somebody who had been given bad news or had faced some bad news and was unable to really grieve in a way that most people do. The experts call that complicated grief. It's not called complicated grief because it's too hard to understand or something. It's called complicated grief because there's obstacles in the way of expressing it. That's what I think we're all experiencing now so much with the COVID-19 situation. We have the losses of the disease, the losses of economics, and then the social isolation piled on, so our grief gets complicated.
That's John, a recently retired prison chaplain from Marshall, Missouri. And I'd love to hear from both of you about this, but Sonia, I'll start with you. Complicated grief. Can you tell me more about that?
Yeah. Let me first say that any grief process is a complicated one. I want to be really clear about that. But complicated grief, as it's used in the clinical sense, refers to someone who, after at least a year, and I say that very tentatively, acknowledging that, you know, grief is lifelong, but what should happen or what we think that we can typically do under all of the right circumstances is within a year or so be able to integrate the loss of a loved one into our day-to-day living. So if after a year or so, an individual is still feeling that their grief and all of the task of finding meaning and finding purpose in living after the loved one is still very acute or still interfering with their day-to-day functioning, then we think about that as a clinical condition of complicated grief. That diagnosis, if you will, or condition is limited to grief as a result of the loss of a loved one. However, John is correct in saying that as we have more losses, previous losses, David spoke about this also, that it's triggering people now, the fear of losing more loved ones, or if they actually do lose another loved one dies. That along with all the losses of the illusion of control, maybe our financial stability, you know, our social connections in person and so on, the losses become compounded.
Yeah.
So in mental health, what we're going to be called to do after we move through this crisis is to find new ways to give name and voice and ways of coping to this new way of being and the complicated losses or the compounded losses that we are all experiencing. Yeah.
Well,
if that makes sense.
It does. And David, we've just got about 30 seconds before I have to head into another break here, but I wanted to hear your thoughts on this.
I love Sonia's definition of it because I think the reality, it is about integration. Sometimes I've heard it put in other ways, that our grief is complicated if a feeling about it lasts longer than 6 months or a year. And, you know, the reality is I'm going to be sad for the rest of my life around my younger son dying. It doesn't mean it's complicated grief, but I agree with her. Everything's complicated in grief. Yeah. So we have to be careful not to really, you know, put labels on people either.
Right. Mm-hmm.
True. That's
well,
true.
Grief is a natural process of life.
Yes.
Well, David Kessler and Sonia Lott, hang on here for just a second. We've got a lot more to talk about when we come back, including hearing from both of you and how we push forward through all this and what we should do to find that meaning in this moment. So we'll be back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about grief and grieving in a global pandemic. And I'm joined today by David Kessler. He is the founder of grief.com. He's co-authored several books, with at least one book with Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, called On Grief and Grieving. And his newest book is Finding Meaning, the Sixth Stage of Grief. We have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Sonia Lott also joins us. She's a psychologist specializing in anticipatory, acute, and complicated grief counseling. She's also founder and CEO of Continuing Education in Multicultural Psychology, and also hosts a podcast called Reflections on Multicultural Competence. And David and Sonia, if you can just hang on here for a second, I want to turn now to another On Point listener, Jennifer Rose Valley. She joins us from New York City. Jennifer, how are you doing?
I'm okay, thank you.
Yeah, it's been
I'm okay now.
Yeah, and tell us what it's been like over the past couple of days and weeks.
My husband was diagnosed with corona, pneumonia, and the flu.
At the same time?
Yeah. He was diagnosed about 2.5 weeks ago. He probably had it a good week before that as well. It got increasingly scary as he wasn't able to breathe. There was a lap between the time we knew he had corona and the time we knew he had pneumonia, but we didn't know he had corona for about, maybe 5 days, because there was some problem with the machine that was giving the results. So that was really scary, really scary. And he was breathing like, really short, rapid, stressed kind of. It was really scary. He didn't want to go to the hospital. And I felt as long as he could breathe, and he was breathing, this was only happening when he'd get out of bed to go to the bathroom. So other than that, he was breathing. If he was breathing and he didn't have temperature, it was probably best to keep him home. Having worked in a hospital, I knew the dangers.
Yeah.
So we kept him home. And once then the doctor, I think it was over a weekend that was happening. And then on Monday, the doctor gave him a inhaler and then he could breathe. So that just reaffirmed that staying home was okay.
Well, but Jennifer, I'm just listening to you. I can imagine that it was impossible not to put for your mind to wander down sort of the path of a dark future.
Oh, my God, you have no idea. All the negative predictions, all my fears about, I knew it could tank at any moment. And just to compound it, it was the anniversary of my mother's death was yesterday. Wow. The first year anniversary, yeah. So, and I had been the caretaker. So I was completely traumatized by that and getting past that. And, you know, I knew the one-year mark would be hard. It was hard, but actually once we knew he had corona, I was actually relieved. Isn't that weird?
Mm-hmm.
I was actually relieved to put a name on it and a face on it, knowing, you know, that was a little better than the unknown.
Right.
So dealing with the two together, being confined on Manhattan, one of my fears was they'd cut off the bridges and we wouldn't be able to go anywhere. You know, there's something about being locked in. The negative predictions were amazing.
Wow.
Well, and the lack of resources.
Jennifer, hang on here for just a second, because I also want to let people know that, first of all, I appreciate it. Thank you so much for sharing your story, and I appreciate your deep honesty, especially given the fact that you are a professional psychotherapist. So, like, even those of us with the tools already at hand are struggling, and I appreciate you sharing this. So hang on, Jennifer. Don't hang up, because I wanted to turn to David here for a second. I mean, David, talk to Jennifer. What would you tell her? It sounds like she's giving us the perfect lived example of like, just anticipatory grief, feeling grief in the moment, even as she's trying to care for her husband.
Exactly. So when we talk about anticipatory grief, we often talk about the healthy anticipatory grief. We grow up knowing someday when our parents get much older, they will die at some point. And our mind is subtly preparing for that our whole life. However, in a pandemic like this, our mind, just like both of you talked about, our mind shows us the worst images, or you turn on the TV and you can see the worst images in Italy and other places. Our mind shows us the worst scenarios. Now, they could come true. That is true in a pandemic. At the same time, I also tell people there's a set of best scenarios too. Your loved one could get sick, but could survive it, or maybe they won't get it at all. So I try to just help people keep our mind in balance, that if your mind's showing you the worst, just know the best is also a possibility. We don't know the future yet, but I always say we don't ever want to attend anyone's funeral early.
Right.
So let's not get lost in the bad images.
Yeah. Sonia, what do you have to say for Jennifer?
One, I too appreciate her willingness to share. And as David said, just because we're mental health professionals, I mean, we still are dealing with our own issues. And I'm reminded that fear isn't always fear versus anxiety. Fear, the feeling when there is real threat versus anxiety about sort of wondering about potential things that could be catastrophic in the future. That fear helps. It's a signal that something is wrong. Your husband was and is sick, hopefully doing much better, but it helps us to prepare for what we have to deal with in the moment. So fear isn't always a bad thing. It's just when it overtakes us or we become overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. So, fear helps us to act in ways that help to keep us alive, as in the case of your support of your husband. But the fear of, oh my goodness, my husband might die, was real, is real, even if you weren't dealing with still the first anniversary of your mom's passing. It's all of this is normal. So many of us, and not you specifically, Jennifer, but I'm just saying in general, so many people feel like when we get caught in the fear, oh my goodness, you know, something bad's going to happen, or I'm really struggling with the death of a loved one a year later, or someone else might die. That's normal. Mm. We are all experiencing collective grief and anxiety, and it's normal. We're responding to a reality. It's just about making sure as best we can that we have all the support that we need, that we're able, as David said, to imagine that just like the worst could happen, the best that we can even perceive right now is also a possibility. Mm-hmm.
Well, Jennifer, first of all, has your husband turned the corner?
Oh, my God, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank God, yes.
Thank goodness, yes. Yeah. And so can you help us collectively learn from your experience? I mean, what would you tell people right now about who are...
I think everything, thank you, both of you, David and Sonia, that's absolutely what I practiced. I meditated. I have a lot of friends. Some are in the mental health industry, some are medical industry, and some of them are just amazing people, a lot of artists. And everybody was incredible. I really let myself take in what the support they had to offer. Mm-hmm. Some of them were on the phone with me like several times a day, just coaching me, you know, and reminding me to breathe and just, you know, reality checks. We also, my son happens to be here, and that was my rock. He was amazing. He just kept, help keep the normalcy. And I try to, and I tell people this all the time, try to keep as much normalcy as possible. This Alvin Ailey has some free classes online. I followed that and I did some classes just to keep some normalcy, keep myself moving, take care of myself. I kept working in the middle of all this and I was able to focus on my work. My husband was sleeping a lot, so it was okay. I mean, I was working in the bathroom because my husband was sleeping in the bed. I live in a one-bedroom apartment in Manhattan, and any of you know what a one-bedroom apartment in Manhattan looks like. It's
right, tiny. Right.
And my son had the living room. He was working. And my husband had the bedroom. He was sleeping. So I was in the bathroom, and I was telling everybody I'm in the bathroom. You know, but again, normalizing.
And isn't it good we can laugh about it
now? Exactly.
Yeah.
I'm sure there were times you weren't laughing in the bathroom, but we can laugh about it now. You know, one of the things that's so important about what you're sharing in your call, and also just every, you know, all of us doing this show, and thank you for doing this show, is that, you know, we often talk about if you're driving somewhere and you have one flat tire, that's news. If you get there safely, it's not news. So while the news tends to be how everyone's dying, you sharing this story reminds us, no, everyone's not going to die from this. Some people are going to pull through. It's going to be inconvenient. We're going to be working in the bathroom, but people are going to pull through and life will continue for most of us. And we need that hope. And when people become hopeless right now, I say, you know, I will hold your hope for you.
Yes,
we may
yes.
temporarily lose our hope, but it is temporary. The loss of hope is always temporary, and we can always find it again.
Well, right. Jennifer Rose Valley, On Point listener calling us from New York City. First of all, so glad to hear your husband has turned a corner, and thank you so much for sharing your story with us today.
You're very welcome.
David and Sonia, we've got about 5 minutes left here, and I am deeply, deeply desirous of hearing about making meaning, finding meaning in this moment. And David, can I just start with you and forgive me for asking this, but did you find meaning in the grief that you experience and are still experiencing over your son's death?
That was my quest in writing that book, to help myself and other people find meaning. And the book itself is so meaningful for me. And the fact that it's been on the bestseller list and reaching so many people means it's resonating and helping other people find meaning. A couple of cautions. When we talk about meaning, it doesn't mean you're not going to go through pain. Mm-hmm. The pain still exists. Meaning gives the cushion. And the other thing I learned is the meaning is not in the death. There's no meaning in my son dying. There's no meaning in someone dying by suicide or having a horrible illness by cancer or Alzheimer's or a sudden death. There's not meaning in the death, but there's meaning in what we do after. And the meaning that I found in the book, one of the things I realized is that my son in kindergarten had been voted the most likely to be a helper. And in his life, because he died at 21, he never got to be that helper. And now through this book, in death, in a way he didn't do in life, he's getting to help so many people that I'll never see or know, but he will. And so that brings me great meaning. And I think we're having to struggle with, some of us are going to come out of this with post-traumatic stress after this pandemic. But part of my work in meaning is to also remind people we can come out with post-traumatic growth also. Mm-hmm. And post-traumatic growth is the meaning that actually occurs more than post-traumatic stress. And, you know, just like your listener talked about, we're trying to find ways. I hope that people will tune into our free online Facebook group. And like tonight, we're having, she mentioned meditation. Tonight, we're having Paul Denniston, who does grief yoga. He's going to be doing a meditation. If people tune in for that, you know, just to help calm our ways, our lives after a loved one has died, yeah. We still need to connect with community.
Yeah. Well, Sonia, I'm thinking about also people who say are grieving profoundly because they lost their jobs and they're worried about putting food on the table or keeping a roof over their head. I mean, how would you assist them or tell them where to begin to find meaning in the challenges that they're facing now?
Well, I want to say one thing before answering that around finding meaning in the death of a loved one. And I think in a more spiritual way, and David, I know that you're very spiritual too, that there can be meaning in the death of a loved one in a more spiritual collective sense that there's impermanence. The only thing that doesn't change is change it, that change is going to happen, that it's a very painful awakening to or reminder of impermanence, that the illusions we have of control of our life, for example, it's an illusion. We all are born and we all die. And it's very painful, but we can find meaning in our living through the death of loved ones, and that, if that makes sense. And in the same way, leaning into the loss of the illusion of control right where we are today, that we can begin to be more or less uneasy with impermanence of living, that all things change, and that we can always create some meaning in or purpose in moving forward. If we can hold on to some hope while we are present to the loss, that that hope will move us, propel us forward to stay curious or open open to the possibility that there's something even better than what we've had or in the future.
Well,
if that makes sense.
It makes perfect sense. And in fact, I just want to tell listeners that it's so such a beautiful partnership here, because both of you have talked about hope. And tomorrow on our program, actually, we're going to be talking with writer, historian, and activist Rebecca Solnit about how hope blossoms in the midst of a disaster. So listeners, by the way, I mean, we want you to call us at 617-353-0683. That's 617-353-0683. And let us know how you're maintaining or even blossoming hope during these extremely challenging times, and where you're looking for sources of hope as well. So that's what we're going to do tomorrow. But on that note, even though I could talk to both of you probably for 10 to 20 more hours, I'm going to have to wrap up. So Sonia Lott, psychologist specializing in anticipatory, acute, and complicated grief counseling, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And David Kessler, author of Finding Meaning, The Sixth Stage of Grief. We have an excerpt of it at our website, onpointradio.org, and he's also founder of grief.com. David, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for doing this. Really appreciate it.
I have to say, I felt extremely fortunate that one of the things that I have learned in the midst of this disaster is I had the luxury to care about things that didn't matter. So I'm going to stop caring about those things and just fiercely love the people in my life even more. So thank you for that. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.